From National Public Radio, I'm Sanford Unger, and this is NPR Dateline, Washington, Tuesday, March 29th.
This guy was a superstar. He arrived at Harvard. He was had golden hands. He made all the experiments work just the way everybody wanted him to. It turned out that his beautiful body of knowledge that he had generated was tainted to the very bottom.
Fraud in science. More cases are in the news all the time, provoking charges that dishonesty in science is no random aberration, but the natural outcome of a faulty system. We'll ask whether science has been unduly glorified and whether the public has suffered as a result. Science fraud, coming up on NPR Dateline. First, a summary of this hour's news.
Good evening. We're all pleased to have with us this evening Dr. Alfred Clothiers, the world-famous expert on bears. Dr. Clothiers, you've recently discovered how bears know when to go to sleep for the winter, and you reached your conclusion by following the scientific method.
That's right, the scientific method. I had a question, I formed a hypothesis, and I observed closely. When I'd gathered enough reliable information, I was able to reach my conclusion.
Byron B. Black Bear, a fictional character used to teach children about science. He invokes a laughable faith in the scientific method. Many of us are brought up to have such faith, to believe that scientists do not share the usual human frailties. But recently, that faith has begun to crack. This is NPR Dateline. I'm Sanford Unger. The stories are almost commonplace now. An eager, bright, highly respected young researcher at a major medical research center is challenged on his results. Upon examination, his work turns out to have included some shortcuts, flaws, or even falsified data. His superiors or his peers re-examine his earlier work and find problems there, too. He's relieved of some responsibilities, perhaps fired, certainly ostracized. But soon the scientific community closes ranks. It assures the outside world that this is an aberration, a rotten apple in a barrel of excellent specimens. The latter point, that science is a noble profession rarely tainted by dishonesty, has been boldly challenged in a new book. It's called Betrayers of the Truth, Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science. One of its two authors, William Broad, says this really is a problem that goes back centuries.
Galileo performed experiments that his contemporaries couldn't duplicate. They had questions about whether he had really done them all the way he said he had. Newton had a glaring fudge factor right in the midst of his most famous opus, and that didn't get picked up for about 250 years. So history is laced with examples of people cleaning up their data, not totally fabricating stuff out of thin air, but making the results a little bit better than they might seem otherwise.
It's interesting that all these historical examples you give are cases of people whose work we accept entirely now. Given that historical record, should that make us more relaxed about this, maybe?
I think not, because today we're seeing an epidemic of much more serious cases of fraud, a clear agreement in the scientific community that sort of the inducement to fraud is increasing. When people, because of the pressures to publish and because of the increasing careerist nature of science, are fabricating results out of thin air, and they're results that have bearing on our daily lives, on our health and our welfare. When people make up studies that have to do with new cancer drugs or with heart medicines or with treating anorexia nervosa, as one of the famous cases did, it makes the magnitude of the problem much larger, and it hits a lot closer to home.
How does the scientific community explain all these examples of fraud?
The standard line is that these are just rotten apples in the barrel of science, and every once in a while, the self-policing mechanisms of science find one of these rotten apples, at which point they're promptly thrown out. In fact, one of the things that Nicholas and I discovered in the course of our research is that those policing mechanisms work seldom, if ever, the way the scientific community says they do.
Well, how are they supposed to work?
There's a triple safety net. Without getting into too much detail, there's the peer review of grants. The people at NIH and those kind of federal agencies that give out the money weigh the merits of scientific research. There's also the refereeing of papers. When a scientist writes up a bit of research, he submits it to a journal, and that in turn goes out to referees that pass judgment on the merit of the work. And then finally, after a piece of work is published, there's the replication of experiments in which scientists in distant labs are supposed to independently test the validity of the results. Those mechanisms and those institutional mechanisms that scientists say work so well often, in fact, don't. So you have the maybe an increased inducements to fraud on one hand, and the police system of science, which is more a myth than a reality.
William Broad is a science reporter for the New York Times. One critic of his book is Harriet Zuckerman, professor of sociology at Columbia University. She thinks the allegations about scientific research go too far.
The authors of the book make three claims, one of which I think is important. The three claims are that fraud and deception are endemic in science, that is, they're very common. The second thing they claim is that the usual procedures that scientists use to control deceit don't work. And last, they say that the scientific community has not dealt effectively or expeditiously with the cases that have come to recent public light. That, I think, is a serious problem, one which they are quite right to make a considerable amount of.
What about the first two claims in the book? First of all, that fraud and deception are very common in the scientific community.
I think, in fact, nobody knows. There is simply no way of knowing how frequent or frequent it is. All we have are the cases that have come to public light. And to make any claims whatsoever about the frequency of these actions, it just strikes me as being not having been sufficiently substantiated.
What about their other allegations?
The second claim, that's that the standard procedures of science don't do very well in picking up cases of fraud, plagiarism, self-deception, and the like, I don't think holds water. Science requires that truth claims be at least reproducible. That is, that other scientists who try to do it again will come out with the same answers. And this requirement that science be reproducible is a very important curb on fraud and deceit.
Harriet Zuckerman, professor of sociology at Columbia University. But does replication really occur, and does peer review work? To thrash out some of the issues of fraud in science, we put together Nicholas Wade, the other author of Betrayers of the Truth, and Dr. Ronald Lamont Havers, research director at one of the most prestigious medical institutions in this country, Massachusetts General Hospital. Mass General was the scene of one of the more highly publicized medical frauds of recent years. It involved a young researcher at the Harvard Medical School named John Long.
It came to our attention when one of the younger research fellows working with Dr. Long questioned some results which he had submitted for publication and asked to see the background documentation on it. Gradually, one evening while he was sitting looking at it, he noticed that there was something on the page which wasn't right. Something had been pasted on the page, another diagram. Then he discussed this with Dr. Long. Dr. Long said it was fine, but he still persisted. He then went and addressed the chairman of the department, and indeed it turned out that the data which had been submitted for the publication had been falsified.
Now, were you satisfied, Dr. Lamont Havers, that the system dealt successfully with this case of falsified data?
I think that we did handle this case successfully. That indeed he probably had been changing results for some time, so that therefore I think that Long is typical of the individuals which seem to be involved in this type of fraud or misconduct. Everybody seems to like them and get along with them in the beginning. Then you have a period when people are somewhat suspicious but don't like to say anything, and then something precipitates the fact that they indeed are manipulating data.
Mr. Wade, what are the lessons that you draw from the case of John Long?
Well, I think they're a little different. The wider lessons have to do with the checking mechanisms of science. I mean, science is said to be a self-correcting system, but if you look at all the mechanisms that provide this self-correction, none of them succeeded in picking up what Long was doing. He went through the peer review system and was awarded large sums of money by the government. The referees failed to see what was wrong with his papers. And no one tried to replicate his results, even though they stood out apart from all the other results gained in that field. None of those three mechanisms picked up long. He was picked up, as Monhavis has just described, by a research associate who happened to doubt certain figures and asked Long for his lab books.
Dr. Monhavers, what about the suggestion that the peer review system just doesn't work and
Well, you know, I feel that the one thing about scientists is that they are very human and that they represent all of the frailties of humanity, which each one of us.
Well, then you're suggesting that he was sort of a bad apple that gives the barrel a bad reputation.
Yeah, but there are certainly a large number, you know, just the same way we have DeLoreans and everything else in the other areas. There are a certain number of these. I don't think it's widespread. And I certainly don't think that they do it because of the pressures they're under. Certainly everybody in biomedical research is under tremendous pressures. But these people do it, I think, because they're taped that way. They would do it wherever they were.
How about that, Mr. Wade? Is this a more serious, more fundamental problem in the scientific research community?
Well, I think it is because of the way it contradicts the manner in which science is supposed to work. And science is meant to be a community of scholars who are always checking each other's results. And that's why the product, the certified knowledge that comes out of it, is meant to be somehow different, superior to other forms of knowledge, because it has gone through all these cross-checking mechanisms. Science is more than just the individuals who make it up. That's why I'm unhappy at Dr. Monhever's emphasis on Long, the individual who went wrong. Sure, Long did go wrong, but the next question is, well, how did the system respond in picking up what was happening? And the system simply didn't respond at all. None of its checking mechanisms picked up the falsification in Long's data.
Well, Dr. Monhavers, do you suppose that the credibility, the integrity of people has to be questioned more often in order to try to catch this?
Well, I think where these things happen, you know, it becomes a tremendous shock, and you begin to look at what in the world you have done. And at that point, you begin to put in mechanisms. In every case, the results were just too perfect. And I think that what we're beginning to realize is that we're going to have to check more closely those type of results. Certainly in our own institution, and I know in others,
That could almost invite more clever frauds in the future, people who don't...
Well, I have infinite faith in the humanity to manipulate the system, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Dr. Ronald Lamont Havers is research director at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And Nicholas Wade, formerly a reporter for Science Magazine and now a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, is co-author of Betrayers of the Truth. Wade and his co-author, William Broad, do have some suggestions for changes in the system. Again, William Broad.
There's one fix that shouldn't be done, and that would be some sort of FDA police system that would lurk in the labs. And, I mean, people in Congress have made those kind of suggestions. And that would be incredibly burdensome and counterproductive. It would bring research to a halt. But there's a couple of simple steps that could probably be taken which would help reduce some of these increased incentives to fraud. One of which would be weighing researchers' work more on its intrinsic quality rather than on the quantity of it. Science has become rife with the paper counting game, by which, you know, the longer or the thicker your curriculum vitae, the better chance of a top job you have. And that kind of paper counting is invidious because it breeds that sort of inducement to just keep cranking out the papers, and it doesn't matter if you cut corners. Another reform is a fairer division of credit for the work that's done. Hmm. Instead of having a senior researcher kind of rule a laboratory from afar and still get the credit, I think a system whereby the person that does the work getting the credit for a paper would remove some of that cynicism that we see in so many of these cases.
Science reporter William Broad. With us now is Dan Greenberg, editor of Science and Government Report and a frequent commentator from Washington on issues of medical research. Mr. Greenberg, I wonder what your speculation is on how frequent these instances of fraud really are in medical research.
Well, Sandy, I think like Dr. Zimmerman said, there's really no way of knowing. We can't really take any sort of poll and determine this with any kind of precision, but we do have a fair amount of evidence that indicates that a good amount of it does go on. What I think is most disturbing is the kind of bunker mentality that the leadership of the scientific community reveals whenever any question is raised about the purity of science. There's no reason to assume that there isn't some dishonesty and fraud in science. It seems to exist in almost every other sector of life, business, sports, testing at school, what have you. Why not in science?
It's interesting because the reaction to this book by Mr. Broad and Mr. Wade has been fierce in the scientific community. There's been some people say it's really defensiveness on the part of the scientific establishment.
Well, I think that Wade and Broad have really touched a raw nerve. The scientific community does not take kindly to any suggestion that it is not pure, that it is not working entirely in the public interest, and I think that this sort of response was to be expected.
Do you think there's anything to the charge that they make that historians of science, sociologists of science, teachers in grammar school generally, I mean, all of us, have sort of idealized the way that science works, have over-glamorized the scientific method and profession?
Well, I think it is the last establishment on the American landscape that still is wrapped up in myth. The press really hasn't gone after it. In fact, this is one of the first books, I think, that really probes inside the actual workings of science at the lab bench and raises serious questions about its ethical content. The scientific community has constructed a great many myths that I think that have been embellished by the press. And the public gets this view of science as being an enterprise that is entirely dedicated to the public interest, that is self-effacing and so forth. A book like this just sends them up the wall. They can't stand it.
I guess the next question then is, how much should the public worry? I mean, how much of this trust that we've been putting in scientists to tell us, you know, what drugs to take, what's safe and what's proper in the treatment of disease and so on, how much of that should we take at face value?
Well, I think the internal ethical standards of the scientific community are obviously very important, but I think perhaps even more important than most of us will, you know, realize at first glance. We depend upon the scientific community for just an awful lot of information that we can't obtain by ourselves.
We can't understand if it's right or wrong very often either.
Right. And I think that if science is going to be given this trusted role in our society, that its own house should be in order. And it really can take refuge in this rather simplistic response, well, there's a rotten apple in every barrel, and this happens once in a while. I think Wade and Broad are absolutely right when they say that this is kind of built into the system. If it isn't encouraged by the system, it certainly is tolerated. And I think in many ways, in fact, it is encouraged. When you have senior professors putting their names on in a period of relatively few years, 300-400 papers, as a matter of fact, it is just impossible for them to have had any serious involvement with the production of those papers.
So there's a kind of fraud just in that presentation.
Well, we get not only fraud, but we get a bit of comedy, too, because the professors, the senior professors, are quite happy to have their names on the papers when there's glory to be reaped from them. But then when some difficulties are revealed in the manner in which these papers were put together, they'll say, well, I didn't know about it. I trusted this youngster in the lab. Hmm. Well, old story, you can't have it both ways.
That's sort of a cop-out. They want to have the credit, but also credit for policing the system.
Yeah, and I don't think either they should be permitted to take refuge in the fact that we can't pinpoint with any sort of numerical precision just how often this goes on. That's not the point at all.
Thanks very much, Dan Greenberg, who's editor of Science and Government Report in Washington. That's NPR Dateline for today. We had assistance from member station WGBH in Boston. Thanks also to the Learning Corporation of America for an excerpt from its videotape, Byron B. Blackbear and the Scientific Method. Today's program was produced by Joe Minoski. In Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.